program on Middle Earth Network Radio. My name's Riley Blanton. I'm with you here live. It's Wednesday night, and you may or may not know my voice from the Star Wars Report podcast, but we're not here to talk about Star Wars tonight. We've got some awesome guests for this very special live episode on Middle Earth Network Radio, but first let me bring in my co-host in arms. That's a new title, by the way.
Bethany,
welcome to the show.
Why, thank you. I like this new introduction.
All right. I'm glad you did. I'm glad that didn't backfire. tonight we're talking wars. And like I say, not Star Wars. We're actually talking wars. We have the pleasure of interviewing three different authors for a company called GrailQuest Books to talk about the franchise wars. Let's go ahead and get the introductions out of the way. First, we have Sean E. Williams. He's an independent filmmaker who's known for the indie film Blues and is a part of the writing team on the new Ferrest comic book title, a spinoff of the Vertigo's, a little tongue-tied there, Vertigo's popular Fable series. And he also penned the Great Journey novella in Preludes, representing the Gonjin faction in Wars. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Riley.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to asking you guys some questions, but let's go ahead and get with guest number two, Mr. Jim Perry. He's no stranger to those in the world of podcasting and Star Wars fan audio, your pop culture-themed podcast, The Adventures of Indiana Jim, and also the very popular fan audio drama Star Wars Codename Starkeeper. And, of course, now in Preludes, you're known for his Firefight at Overwatch Command, a story exploring the origins of the character fan favorite Jack Wilgris. Welcome to the show, Jim.
That sounds like me.
I think it's you. We're pretty sure. I hope so.
Close.
And last but not least is, of course, a good friend of mine, Nathan P. Butler, of course, author of Healers and Hunters in the Earther novella in Preludes, and also has contributed to the Dark Horse Comics Star Wars series, and of course, not to forget works of original fiction, Greater Good, and of course, the voluntarily composed and massive, and ladies and gentlemen, it is massive, Star Wars continuity fan work, the Star Wars Timeline Gold, and also beginning a brand new Star Wars podcast here on Middle Earth Network and StarWarsReport.com, Star Wars Beyond the Films, beginning in January. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, good to talk again.
It's good to talk to you, Nathan. It's been a while since we talked in podcast form, and so it's a lot of fun. And I'm anxious to talk to you once again and get into some conversations with Sean and Jim as well. I'd like to go ahead and field this question to all three of you, and you can kind of bounce off of each other's definitions in your own experience as an author. What is Wars?
What you've got basically is it's a franchise that began as a card game from Decipher Inc. shortly after the end of the very popular Star Wars customizable card game, Star Wars CCG, and it uses many of the same mechanics from the original Star Wars game there, as opposed to all the later ones that came out since. But it is a universe that is sort of built around predominantly our solar system, and it places three different human factions at odds with each other, and then you have two alien races, the Xi and the Kuei, who are also at odds with each other, and brings them into the picture. And you wind up essentially with a solar system at war, but it's definitely plural, wars, because you have all these different interplays of these conflicts where it is one big spanning mess, but at the same time, there are specific rivalries out there. It's a lot like World War II. You know, some people say European theater, Pacific theater, but all one war. Same kind of general concept, with the main groups here being the Earthers, who are essentially capitalism gone wild, turning into something that's a more business-oriented culture. You've got Gonjin or Mars, which essentially is sort of an idealized version of a Chinese communism, where instead of it being people in charge actually making the decisions, it's more like an AI system that's doing that. So it takes out some of the corruption angles that could go with that. And then you get the Mavericks, who are out there basically saying, we don't want anything to do with either of you. We're going to live our own lives. And we're focusing predominantly on those three human factions, with the novellas being about 3 years before the start of the game. So no alien races in the picture just yet.
Okay, that makes sense. And it seems like the series does deal a lot with not just global politics at this point, but multi-planet politics. And you guys do seem to kind of translate in the storyline what it would look like with our current culture and our current governing system that we have now, how that would evolve. It's kind of, it seems to be like a look at what would happen with our current political ideologies that we're familiar with here on Earth right now. How does that pan out when you guys, as authors, and I'll just field this question to anyone who'd like to answer, how do you go about trying to translate what we know of as global politics now into what that would look like in a very technologically advanced society?
Well, it's actually, if I could jump in, it's sure. It's actually kind of scary how realistic wars is becoming on a number of fronts. The fact that like corporations are getting the same rights as individuals here in the United States is really reflective of the way the Earther culture is set up in wars. The nuclear meltdown that happened in Japan last year is really, I mean, that's kind of what happens to get the Asian cultures fleeing Earth and heading over to Mars and establishing the Ganjin culture. So it's kind of amazing what the Cypher was able to set up in 2004 and how our society is kind of, you know, making that come true.
Okay, and before we move forward, I would be so remiss if I didn't introduce a fourth person that we're interviewing. That's, of course, Josh. That's you from GrailQuest Books. I would be remiss if I didn't bring you into the conversation officially.
That's okay. I don't mind being the silent voice.
Oh, the ghostly voice.
It's kind of like Shaco, you know, just a voice that comes in and...
There you go. But Nathan, I know you're a history teacher by trade, mm-hmm. By day, so to speak. But do you see wars as a way that you can kind of predict the future of our politics?
To a degree, I would hope that we won't find ourselves in a position where we're, in a sense, colonizing our first other planet only to wind up in essentially a new Cold War all over again, eventually a new hot war, but that kind of seems like the pattern we usually get into anyway. I actually, being the history teacher, there's a couple of ways I've had to approach this from the history standpoint. Healers and Hunters was the first of the novella series. And not just the first of the Earthers, but the first released out of the whole thing. And I kind of had to play the Tim Zahn role in the sense of reintroducing a universe to people who may not necessarily have checked it out as much before. And part of that is you have to find ways to describe things in terms that while fitting that future universe, it's still fitting in with what we would expect nowadays so that the terminology doesn't wind up tripping people up. The second one that should be coming out for me, or the fifth one overall in the series, second Earther one, that should be coming out early next year, I really got to play a lot with the idea of the historical parallels. Things like there's a scene, for instance, which is reminiscent of Bob McNamara back during the Cuban Missile Crisis, instances of people destroying documents before hostilities break out, things like that. I think it's less that it's going to help us predict anything looking forward so much as the stories we tell do what good science fiction is supposed to do, which is reflect back on who we are now and who we have been in the past and the cycles that we tend to go through, that human nature is human nature, whether we're firing energy weapons at each other or we're throwing sticks at each other. It's that universal theme of humanity no matter what. And it's helpful that with the Wars universe, you have so many different diverse characters. We have the ability to get into their heads and stick with them as characters through the story, rather than it being all about, say, the technology. The technology is a big part of it, but when that becomes a sheer focus, it disappears. To paraphrase or borrow and tweak a phrase from George Lucas, technology without good characters is a pretty boring thing.
Yes, indeed. And Jim, you mentioned that you write more for a specific character, and I was going to ask you and Nathan, what's it like writing in a fairly large universe where you have to balance the technology and the huge overarching storyline with individual characters and stories that the readers are supposed to care about and the players care about?
I try not to get too technical on the, on the technology side. I don't try to delve too much into a lot of things. I sort of paint with a broad brush because I guess I'm more interested in the characters. It's sort of like the tech is just basically a prop. I guess from my standpoint. I'm not sure if that actually addresses the question that you're trying to ask, but
no, that's neat.
Okay.
Yeah, I think in my case it's kind of the same thing as when I wrote for Star Wars Tales, which is that the focus has to be on the characters. Like Jim was saying, you know, the technology can't be the focus. You got to just sprinkle it in. What I've found is that over the years, as I've gotten better at writing, it's gotten me to the point where I'm starting to feel those natural moments where you can slip in some exposition into the narrative to try to explain some of those things or the history of it, especially from an Earther standpoint, because these people are very deep in the political issues that are going on and the technological stuff that's going on in the universe. So it's an easy segue into talking about those, you know, a paragraph here, a paragraph there, things like that. What I would actually say is probably the toughest job and the job that I didn't envy when it comes to making different time periods fit together would be what Sean was having to do with The Great Journey, because he had two time periods, two different characters having to be worked with, both of which are in our future. So that, I think, would probably have been the toughest part of the whole thing. Sean, I mean, did that free you more, or did that constrain you more? Because I know that probably would have driven me crazy.
Well, not only that, but just to jump in real quick before Sean answers that, Sean actually had to focus on the technology, unlike, you know, Jim, where Jim can go off and just kind of do his adventures and whatnot, and the Earthers are not really so much focused on that. But, I mean, Sean had to develop a technological character and give it something a little bit more than – because the Shaco AI is not just something that dictates the society completely. It doesn't quite do that. And so, I mean, I know I would like to know from Sean as well, you know, how is it to have to develop a piece of technology as a character and give it attributes so that the reader can identify with it on some level?
That was actually partly why I wanted to develop the two different time periods, was just to be able to almost use it as a way to flesh out the character myself of Cho-Cho. The nice thing is that Decipher and Michael Stackpole did such a good job of creating the universe to begin with that there were a lot of little clues planted throughout that I could draw from. And fleshing, you know, both the human characters and the AI out. So the outline of the story was basically there already. It was mostly just, you know, trying to humanize it and make it a story that, you know, would be interesting to read. Because normally software development isn't exactly the most exciting reading for people.
In a world... writing code.
Yeah, I can see where that might be kind of a challenge, but I'm kind of curious for you guys, how did the process of actually getting these various novellas to the public go about? What is the creative process there? How do you guys work together or not work together? I'll start with you, Nathan. What is the process of writing one of these novellas?
Well, the first thing, and again, this is sort of the process... the only non-self-published other experience I have from a professional writing standpoint right now is the Star Wars Tales stuff, though Echoes and Greater Good, we're going to be professionally released in the near future. It's sort of the same type of process you would see with any licensed work, where you sort of have three different levels. You've got the copyright holder, the people who actually created whatever it is. You've got the licensee, in this case, GrailQuest Books, and then you've got the writer themselves, the hired talent, essentially. And, you know, it's that process. You come up with the general ideas. You need to make sure it fits a broader story arc that's being developed for the line as a whole. Once you do that, once that synopsis, that plan gets approved on all the different necessary levels, then you wind up starting the writing process. And, of course, that's got to go through different levels of approvals and back and forth until finally it can reach the point where it's been given the okay on all the different levels and can finally be put out. I think probably the more interesting way that we've been able to do this, and this is something I think you could only do in this time period, is it's essentially all online collaboration, and it's such a small core group of writers dealing with these storylines that coordinating it is not nearly the headache as you would have with a franchise that has a ton, perhaps, of a bunch of backstory that has to be gone into. I mean, we're dealing with two card sets and three RPG books as the previously existing background, and then this huge canvas on which to work without a whole lot of restriction. So it's a very give and take, flexible process, but at the same time, there's such an open field that you can really take ideas and run with them.
Wow, that's and for you, Sean, do you approach the novellas? Do you have to do a lot of communication with GrailQuest or with your fellow authors, or is that what's that process like?
I mean, when we're with this first novella, when we were coming up with the stories, we were doing a lot of bouncing back and forth, if I'm remembering correctly. I mean, we started working on this, what, 2 years ago, if I'm remembering?
Yep.
Right. So there's a lot of emails back and forth, just like, especially with the more technical stuff, because it's not like Star Wars where you have Wikipedia to refer to. You know, it was all just kind of, you know, the materials that we were all referencing. And so it's like, hey, does anyone remember, you know, what the capital of Ganjin is? And I actually had to make a capital up because one hadn't been established yet. So it was, yeah, just a lot of back and forth and communicating.
And on top of that, the liaison at Decipher wanted us to make sure that when we did things like space travel, that it was, very realistic in terms of, you know, they didn't want one of these things where a lot of convenient storytelling. They wanted to make sure that we were actually following the conventions of what the travel would be like. So on top of that, we have to go into all these resources and make sure that, you know, if there are characters that need to be at a place at a certain time, especially for another story to take place, that the times, I think that's probably the hardest part of it, at least for me as the editor, is making sure that all the times are matching up and making sure that the characters and the and how they're traveling is as Decipher wants it, which is realistic. So
you don't want to take your audience or your readers out of the world that you guys have created in Wars.
Right, correct.
Yeah, and it makes sense when you approach it like that. And before we continue on with the show, we've got a bunch of folks tuning in from all around the world here on Middle Earth Network Radio, and you're listening to for you guys tuning in, you're listening to an interview with Sean Williams, Jim Perry, and Nathan Butler, and of course Josh from GrailQuest Books as well. I'm Riley Blanton with the Star Wars Report podcast, and with me is my sister Bethany on this roundtable, and I'm really enjoying kind of getting into what you guys are doing. Now, Josh, before we continue on the process, I'd love to talk a bit more about the publishing process and maybe get a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of the politics of the world, which I'm always very fascinated with. But, Josh, before we continue, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about GrailQuest Books' relationship with Middle Earth Network Radio for folks tuning in who would be very interested in this. Not for just the Wars franchise, but also future opportunities.
Yeah, GrailQuest Books and Middle Earth Network decided to partner up in order to... They've got a bunch of projects that they are looking to do, some very exciting stuff. At the moment, I'm working on Princess and the Goblin with them as well, which they're doing as an audio drama. And they're very excited about a lot of the projects that we have, being one of them being Wars. We also have a historical fiction series called Such Crosses. We have a fantasy series called Shadow of the Stars, which is being developed in a variety of formats. And so Middle Earth Network and I, you know, we talked it over, realized that we both had resources that the other could use. And one of the things that we really was looking that we were looking for and needed was a platform. I mean, we've been around now for about 5 years, and one of the hardest things for a new publisher is to get good press, to get a stage where people can see you.
Yes.
So you know, that is something that we're very, very thankful for, that Miller's Network saw that, you know, we had some good stuff, and also saw that we could work together on some other things, and so that's pretty much how that came about.
That's fascinating, and kind of jumping back towards the actual Wars portion. Now, of course, Nathan, you are also our author of Wars: Battle of Phobos, Earthers Number One, and what I noticed when I go to the GrailQuest Books site, is that as I link over to Amazon, you have a Kindle version and the of course the hardback version or the actual paper version. Now I should ask how well, if you don't mind getting into the kind of the marketing side, do the ebook sell versus the paper versions?
That'd be one for I guess I, Josh.
I was gonna say for either of you.
Yeah, the paperback version, which is on the newer side, it's kind of slower because again we haven't really had the coverage yet. Which, being with Middle Earth, we're gonna that will change starting next year.
You do now, sir.
And yeah, we do now. And the Kindle kind of did have a life of its own. It kind of mostly because the Kindle is a brand new kind of technology, and yes, it allows people to sample the work without necessarily have to invest, you know, the full price. So the Kindle versions at the moment are doing a lot better, but you know, it's really up to, you know, I don't think that the book has been out there in terms of coverage enough to really gauge, you know, which one is going to end up being the one that sells more. That's that's actually more a question I would love to revisit a year from now, and because that's something I would be curious about myself.
As a person who's personally fascinated with the franchise, I know that I will be reading these novellas very soon, and I will be reading the digital versions. And I think that's an interesting, like you say, it's an interesting question to revisit, because I'm not surprised. The e-books do seem to have taken off quite a bit, and I think that they can really be the lifeblood of authors like you, Nathan, and Sean, and Jim. I think that really it has the ability to really get word out to an audience that otherwise wouldn't be interested in purchasing. There's a
And I think one of the approaches that we're taking that's a little bit different than what a lot of publishers take is, in our case, what we try to do is we've got the individual novellas being released separately as ebook versions first. So Kindle, Nook readers and such, and you can grab them like that, you know, just right off the bat. Whereas these collected paperbacks, once the 3 volume 1s or the 3 volume 2s, the 3 volume 3s are out, they get put into their own collected editions, and those are released in paperback format. So those who are getting into the digital stuff, I mean, we already know digital media is very much an instant gratification kind of thing. You know, we want it and we want it now. I was just showing my students today how I purchased a Dresden Files book right in front of them in the span of maybe 20 seconds, you know. We want that instant gratification. So to have a new series that's building and building and not have to necessarily wait for the paperback version but can dive straight into the ebook version, I think is a nice advantage to offer to those people who are following the series bit by bit as opposed to those who are waiting a little bit longer for the paper version. I think the digital media fans in this case have a slight advantage over those traditional print media fans.
Yes, definitely, and it does make a difference. I think for folks listening to a podcast that like this, whether they're listening live on the show or whether they hear it in the podcast feed afterwards, they're very likely to go to the Facebook page and then probably go do a pre-order on Amazon because it's you know, very easy, and there's that simplicity factor. I'd love to bring Sean or Jim, either of you, in on this discussion in terms of the publishing process. Is that something you guys think about much, and or do you not really focus on that as you focus on just writing the actual book?
One thing that's fascinating about Wars is the fact that it is 3 factions, and the way Josh and Grailquest Books have you know, decided to release these is, you know, the novellas and number 1, number 2, and number 3, and then, you know, as collected as well. I think it's a really kind of innovative publishing approach for a property like this.
I've been really excited watching the illustrations that have been coming, that I've been looking at with Josh and our illustrator for the forthcoming illustrated versions. That's been exciting to see, and kind of working together with the publisher director and the artist to sort of come to, you know, and really we've agreed pretty much on everything, that everything this guy is making is pretty much awesome. I do not mean that in any exaggerative fashion. I mean, they are simply beautiful, and I can't wait to see that come out. As far as, you know, I like the way Josh has kind of rolled with the punches, the way things have gone. Wanted to start out with the illustrated versions. We weren't able to do that the way we wanted to. And so he kind of had to change on the fly. And that's the beauty of being a small company, is you can do that. The other thing that's been real encouraging for me is that I'm less of a sci-fi guy, and I'm far more into epic and heroic fantasy. You know, obviously big into Tolkien and Robert Jordan. Steven Erikson is another one of my favorites. And so it's been fun to see GrailQuest Books grow as a company and to see some of the opportunities that we might have to work together in the future. Josh and I have kind of discussed preliminary a property that I might go forth with GrailQuest. And it's also been kind of good to see him go out there with the ebooks, kind of trial and error, see what's working, see what's not working, because I plan on independently publishing a few electronic titles myself down the road as soon as I get this darn sequel finished.
Yeah.
So it's been very educational.
You know, that's...
Go ahead.
No, go, please.
No, I was done. I was just putting a tag on that.
No, you go.
No, you go. You go. You go. No, you know, one thing that one thing that's been really interesting too is when you release these, especially by ebook first, as a publisher, you're able. Well, at the moment, it's something that's kind of still building. But the idea is when you release the ebook, you can right away gauge immediate feedback. And it is great as a publisher. The idea that you release the ebook, people read it, they review it. Maybe they don't necessarily review it right on Amazon, but we get feedback personally. And it allows us to, as we write the other stories, to be able to take that feedback and apply it. And sometimes even before we release the paperback version with the collected version, we're able to maybe tweak very, very minor things that we get feedback on, or that someone points something out and we're like, oh yeah, you know, we hadn't really thought of that. You know, it's really nice because eventually when we do release the hardcover version, which is something else that GrailQuest Books is doing a lot different, pretty much different than any publisher that I know of, is that we actually are releasing our hardcover covers last, because we want that to be the definitive version. When people buy that and they put it on their shelf, they know that's it. There are going to be no more corrections, the spelling, and, you know, if there's any type of spelling errors that sometimes sneak through our various proofing processes, that, you know, they're going to know that is the definitive work, and they're going to be able to enjoy it that way. And so it's really interesting when you put the ebook out and you get that kind of feedback. It's really valuable for me, at least as the publisher, and I'm hoping that's also going to be of value to the authors, that they get feedback on their work, because I know that they have such a high, you know, bar of excellence for themselves. You know, that's what they want to do. So at least it's a very different kind of landscape than it was even 10 years ago.
It is indeed.
If I can add on top of what Josh was saying, talking about the immediate feedback, Wars has a smaller fan base than, say, something as giant as Star Wars, but the fan base that is there is very devoted to this game. I mean, the game had a couple of sets, the three different RPG books, and then disappears outside of the original fiction that was still sort of circulating around for those who could get the earlier short stories, some by Michael Stackpole and others. And it is a very hardcore fan base when it comes to that. And they're also a very, I guess, giving fan base is what I want to say, a very good-natured fan base where you can have those conversations. I know Jim did a reading with a fan group at a big event that they had, and I know we've had enough interaction with several different groups of fans, or several different specific circles of fans, I guess is the best way to put it, that we've wound up, I mean, I know in Earther 2, assuming that everything winds up getting the final thumbs up from Decipher, I've had a chance to, on one hand, use a name for a character that was put out there, essentially a, we're creating a new Ganjin character for this particular role. I can't tell you much about him, but what are some suggestions of names? And one of the suggestions from one of the fans was a perfect fit and wound up becoming a character name, or a ship that winds up playing into the background of one of our primary Earther characters, Rogan Hallard, purposely named as a Tuckerism, as they call it, for one of those big fan site operators out there for wars. So you get a chance to interact, and at the same time, while they're thanking us for producing new stuff for this universe they like so much, we're turning around and being able to, in a sense, thank them for the things that we can do to interact with that side of the community, the readership side of things. It's been a really good experience in that regard.
Yeah, in a way, that sounds almost like crowdsourcing for ideas and editing, which is great.
I just have
that sort of interaction level.
I have one question, though. Was it Kadus? Nah. Little inside joke for our Star Wars fans listening.
No. And it will not be a name that it will take you forever to figure out how to pronounce, like Kadus, Kytus, Darth, what? Yeah, him.
Oh, goodness.
The guy that used to be so-and-so. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So let's say that I am a total skeptic. I love The Lord of the Rings and I love Star Wars,
yes.
Both of which are true.
Yes.
But I'm just not sure about this Wars series, whatever it is. Like, you took the star out of it. I'm not sure if I like it anymore. So I'm a skeptic. Convince me to read Wars.
She's throwing down the glove.
Man, it's one of the writers wears a fedora half the time. I mean, how could you not like that, Jim?
Trust him.
Right. I agree with him.
Okay.
but before I'm going to address that in just a second. Real quick, I want to mention you talking about the Wars fans. Nathan has interacted with a lot of them online, especially via Facebook. I just wanted to real quick talk about, I'll just mention that I'm extremely lucky to have found there's a group of folks over at Hanover College, which is Hanover, just a little town on the Ohio River in southern Indiana, and it's only an hour away from where I'm at. And I thought it was really fascinating to find these folks. Their ringleader is Jim Wilder, and he runs card games. They all do an RPG, and I think it must be up to like 7 or 8 players now that they meet every Saturday. And I've had the privilege of being up there a couple times, hanging out with them, and it's just been really cool to see, you know, this property that I didn't even know existed has this established fan base that didn't even know was there. And it's been really fun interacting with those folks, and made some good friends there. As far as you being a skeptic of the Wars universe, it's similar to Star Wars, only there's a lot. We all know the backstory because we've lived the backstory through our history. And it's just like Nathan was saying, there's so many possibilities of places to go with this that I think it's a neat experience to get in on the ground floor of this. You know, it's very, if you've read the Star Wars novels, it's easily accessible. You can jump right in, kind of get a feel for what's going on, and you won't feel lost. By the same token, being a far-flung future of our own history, you can also identify with the themes that have run throughout our history into this this world of Wars. And it's just been, from my angle, I would say it's for the Mavericks, it's a little bit Firefly, a little bit Gunsmoke, and honestly, a little bit Magnum PI.
Interesting.
That's
got the mustache.
That's a far more. Although the fedora is awesome, I think that was a far more convincing argument.
Right? I may have Jack Wilgris wear a Hawaiian shirt. I have not decided yet.
Oh, goodness.
That would be in the comments.
Totally kidding, but he will drive a Ferrari. Yeah, no.
One of your characters, one of these days, will have to wear a fedora. Yeah, just make it happen.
Yeah, the Mavericks do like their hot rods, so
they do. All right, one thing,
cybernetics that are painted in a Hawaiian T-shirt kind of pattern or something.
There you go. One thing, Nathan. One thing that you talk about, and earlier today I was watching some excellent primer videos that you recorded that kind of, for someone who is new to wars, like Bethany was mentioning, that they can go. And you can go to facebook.com/warsuniverse and just click on the videos there, and you'll find what I was watching this morning. And that was some primers of the actual universe and what's going on. And one thing you talk a lot about that really intrigued me and really was convincing me to make some time, actually purchase the novellas and get into this universe, was the role of corporations and how it had, there's this kind of political intrigue nature to, mm-hmm. of what you were describing. In the way that it's, I guess at the beginning of the show, you were talking about it as kind of a idealized form of capitalism in some sense.
Yeah, sort of. It's essentially, I mean, you take where we seem to be in so many cases anyway, with things like, you know, whether it's Blackwater doing independent security operations as opposed to American military and things like that, and the growing voice of corporations, for good or ill. I mean, one of the things I teach is, aside from history, is economics. So there's always that pull of, you know, corporations good, corporations bad. What do they do that's beneficial? What is not? And what you wind up with on Earth, essentially, is you see what seems to happen so often, a court case involving a major company and a major new piece of technology or a major new innovation that they have full control over.
Yeah.
And I guess what you could say is the opposite of a Microsoft case. You instead, in this case, get the government essentially losing. And this corporation uses the leverage of saying, okay, we have this new thing called the grav drive. We have the ability to use this propulsion to explore all over the solar system now, as opposed to being shackled just on Earth or right nearby. We're going to give it to you. We're going to give it to the world, but it comes at a price. We don't want money per se, although we're probably going to make a tidy little sum eventually. But we don't want money. What we want is a seat at the table. And by this point, the world is essentially already united under the United Nations.
So basically,
which I know is a scary
thought. A seat at world government.
Right, like a one-world government where essentially it stops being more about nationality and starts eventually being more about which corporations you're tied into, but it grows into what's called the Central Governance Corporation as businesses gain a seat at the table at the United Nations and slowly grow in their power. So now instead of, say, the CIA, you have CISIN, and CISIN is essentially a corporation focused on intelligence operations. You have FedGrav. You have ICOM. Yeah, there you go. I'm going to my Star Wars stuff. I almost said INCOM. You have ICOM. And all these different corporations who together coordinate while doing business with each other and with their interacting rivalries to create this culture of Earth. And it really gives a nice chance to, I mean, even within Earth culture, to have some great interplays between those different groups. For instance, in Healers and Hunters, you're focusing specifically on the Mavericks and the Earthers. Essentially, Mavericks are trying to get their hands on a piece of technology that has been stolen from, or essentially stolen from a person who used to work for one of the major Earth corporations dealing with technology. And another group, the intelligence gathering group, is trying to acquire that technology. And it's just sort of that interplay and the rivalry between them makes it so that it's not just a dynamic that's simple, I guess, not even black and white, but I guess what, blue, red, and yellow, I guess, between the three different sides. Within the sides, there are those complexities. The Mavericks have their different gangs. Gonjin has different factions within the way that the political structure works. Earth has its multiple corporations. It's a very, again, we said it a few times, sort of a very open universe to have a lot of great possibilities. On the other hand, it almost feels like there's so much out there you want to use, you got to not overload it. You don't want to make this one where you're just name-dropping all over the place, focus on the characters.
Yeah, because it's fascinating to me how many parallels there do seem to be with our current world. It's like, can AT&T purchase T-Mobile? And that large question that's come up recently in our world, you know, there's so many, whether it's the Occupy movements or all these other real life political struggles that have to do with corporations. And it's not to get too much into politics, obviously, but I do find it very fascinating. And by the way, whenever you say CGC, it sounds awfully close to CDC, the Center for Disease Control. I don't know if that's an accident or not.
A decipherism.
One thing that I would The one word I would caution people to say to think is that any of these governments are idealized forms of anything. One thing we've been very careful to cultivate is that, and because I mean the political aspect is an interesting. It's kind of like, you know, the whole thing with Dune, where there's a lot of political kind of things going on in the background. You know, with wars there are political things going on in the background, but the characters are really the important thing, because we've been very careful because of all the kind of political themes that run with each of these factions, and people can identify probably with one of them at least. We've been sort of careful to not set up any one faction as the good guy or the bad guy. Each of these factions has legitimate heroes and legitimate villains. And each of these factions, the kind of political machines that each one uses have their flaws. I think that certainly a world that is run entirely by corporations, while some people might consider that to be, you know, a good step, it has a problem. I mean, there mm-hmm. is a bit of you know, it's got its problems. I mean, we understand, or at least from the game standpoint, you know, the how everything was developed, I can understand how that could happen. But at the same time, you know, there is serious problems when you've got, you know, sort of, at least for the Earthers, they're constantly competing against themselves, which when you're trying to fight a war, it would be like the Marines, the Navy, and the Air Force, and the Army all competing against each other.
Yeah.
In order, you know, so I wouldn't call them an idealized form of government.
It's the intelligence community essentially before 9/11. It's they're all working right for the national security of the United States, and yet they weren't coordinating with each other as well as they should have been. Or in that case, as well as they were legally allowed to, what little they were legally allowed to. I would also say, going on to what he said about you have all these different factions, the different angles to it, and how it's not idealized per se. There's all the flaws there. That's not just a macrocosmic thing. That's not just the big picture sort of thing. We see that in this novella series on the smaller scale as well. One of the characters that we'll meet in the second Earther novella, for instance, not going to go into too much about the character, but suffice to say he is a citizen of one world who happens to have a wife from one of the other factions, a child who is essentially biracial, if you want to use the concept of races for the three different factions here. Mm-hmm. And how does that affect the home life? How does that affect an individual person? And what happens when the choice is being made between husband, wife, child, and what's in the best interest of the family don't necessarily match what's in the best interest of each one's particular people, and where that comes from? You see that all the time in world history, and it's something else that just continues to play forward. And people are people. If you get away from the idea that people are just, we are who we are, we're always going to sort of do the same things repeatedly, it starts to feel less realistic. And Wars has a definite realistic undertone in terms of the way that its characters, and they could be us transported to the future. It's that same beauty that Stargate does. Those characters are us transported to other worlds. In this case, these are, in a sense, us in a future time with the same foibles that anyone has.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing I would like to hear from Sean real quick is...
Maybe?
Jim's going to interject.
I love Skype, by the way.
I wanted to say that I agree with everything Josh said, except, of course, for the fact that the Mavericks are the good guys and everyone else is the bad guys.
Okay.
So that's all.
Okay.
Just wanted that cleared
just
up.
Just for the listening audience there who weren't aware.
Yes, we have no bias amongst our author groups.
There is
no rivalries at all. No one thinks that. Of course that their faction isn't the best, right?
It's not my fault.
But no, I wanted to hear from Sean real quick. It's never. See, I mean, this is what it's like, by the way, when you talk to these guys on email. It's you've got the Maverick author playing the role of the Maverick author. He is bouncing all the other factions off of each other so that he can profit the most, of course.
Exactly.
You know? That's his job.
That's right.
But no, I wanted to ask Sean real quick about when you wrote the character of Shoko. Now, you said that I guess the pronunciation is Shoko. Shocho. I'll never get that right.
According to the Cypher's pronunciation guide.
I'll never get that right.
Yeah, they probably should have published a glossary along with the card game just for everyone's convenience.
Okay. Well,
with Jylan, Wraith, and
right. Sean, when you're writing that character and you have to deal with kind of the political machine of Ganjin, how do you balance, you know, a character that isn't really all about dominating the Ganjin people? You know, how does that play with the AI versus the bureaucracy that's been set up there?
It's definitely a struggle. I mean, for me, I think it's kind of, you know, approaching Shocho as like, you know, as the grandfather figure that, you know, they call him, in that he has, you know, everyone's best interest at heart, and he's not necessarily going to tell you what he's doing, but you just kind of have to trust him, which, you know, obviously puts the characters in conflict with him, especially once politics get involved. So it's, I mean, the nice thing about him is that he can be enigmatic and not, you know, be direct with, you know, with his responses. And so you can kind of, he can hide as he needs to, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. And that, now who do you think, just as the author, I mean, you know, writing these things, who do you think truly controls the Ganjin? Is it the bureaucracy, which is called the Hajimari, and its president, or do you think that Shocho is truly the driving force controlling pretty much everything?
Well, and that's a really great question. You know, it's definitely worth exploring. The thing about Shocho is that he can only do so much. You know, he can control resources and, environmental controls and put things into place so that the humans don't necessarily, or humans or Ganjin at this point, see coming. But as far as like the politics go, I mean, it's kind of, it's almost like ants in an anthill, where the ants are doing whatever they want, but it's and they can have infighting and all this, you know, rivalry stuff going on between them. But then, you know, at the same time, the colony itself is headed in a certain direction. And, you know, to a certain degree, I feel like humanity is similar to that, in that, you know, we're going to end up where we're going to end up, no matter what, you know, political rivalries happen along the way, to some degree, to get a little philosophical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost ironic because you pull in, you know, that Adam Smith, father of capitalism, talks about the invisible hand in the market as being these human behaviors that push us in the right direction. In a sense, Ganjin, who is against the capitalist earthers, they're the ones who have essentially their own invisible hand in this case. It's another one of those great dichotomies of concept that cross over in the Wars universe.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of similarities between each of the cultures that I don't think any of the three are really capable of taking that step back and being like, hey, we're all exactly the same, just in different ways, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely.
Well, I was wondering, what about religion in this future world? Is there an overarching type of religion, or do different factions have different religious beliefs, or is religion much of a factor in this world?
Pretty much the way that the religious aspect was set up is that it continues. The Vatican still exists, and religious groups still exist. But the way it was just developed is that it doesn't have kind of a dominant theme, which probably fits with how, you know, our society is somewhat evolving. In terms of it, if there is religion and faith in wars, it is kept pretty much to oneself. Okay. You know, now that it could also be because Decipher just, you know, wanted to kind of leave that alone. If they figured maybe, you know, we're already fanning the flames with the political aspect, and we'll leave the religious aspect alone. But I've according to, you know, if you look at archaeology and things like that, spirituality is somewhat hardwired into the human psyche, and so I don't think it's an element that will ever, you know, go away. but it's not an element that takes a tremendous front seat. You know, you might come across a character every now and then that is, you know, praying, or you know, there are certain characters, at least, you know, in the Ganjin side of things, that look at mythology and the philosophic aspects of life quite religiously. I would think the Mavericks probably would shoot anyone that talked about religion, but okay. You know, it doesn't play a strong role, but it certainly could. I know that one thing we haven't gotten into a lot really is there is a fantasy element. I mean, I'm not a big science fiction person myself. Wars is like two parts science fiction, one part fantasy, and one part just space adventure. And that fantasy element is going to happen when the Mumon Rift opens. And when that happens, then I think a lot of the kind of spiritual religious stuff is going to start to come to the forefront. And because the Mumon Rift is going to cause certain things to happen to very select people on a supernatural basis. And I think at that point is where you could get into that religious question. But at the moment, it's there. It's sort of continuing as it is now, but it isn't really much of a role.
Yeah.
You know, there's one thing that I actually found.
Religious reasons.
Yeah.
Right. Right. One thing I would say is kind of interesting is the religion, as we all know that religion in the real world gets, you know, shifted around and gets used for political purposes. It can drive political movements and things like that. In Wars, one of the most interesting things I've seen in how Wars has dealt with religion is the Catholic Church undergoes a new schism. And it's very much like what happened with Christianity back in 1054, where you have two different perspectives on what Christianity should be, and you wind up with Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic, and eventually something else leading to Protestant Revolution or Protestant Reformation, and then again and again and again. But in this case, what we have essentially is a Catholic Church divided by the fact that the Catholics on Ganjin do not want to be beholden to a Holy Father at Vatican City on Earth. So essentially there is a new Holy Father, very similar to the split off to Eastern Orthodox for the Byzantines, that is now on Ganjin. So you still, again, it's sort of those historical patterns, but the religion isn't necessarily beaten over the head so much as it is a part of the setting in a lot of ways. It's there, but its influence is much more subtle, and it gives that human experience.
Yeah, and it's interesting because so many people think of there is such a big role of religion in some wars in the past, but I'd just like to think we had some folks in the chat who were asking that question, and we do have a number of people in the chat. I'll tell you what, this hour has blazed by. I'm going to go ahead and get ready to wrap it up, but we're going to definitely have to get you guys back on, if not for the live specials, maybe on the Founders Inklings one week to talk more about wars, and we'll continue on with the next book that is published when?
The next book is scheduled to be out sometime during the winter. We don't have a firm date on it yet. I'm hoping it's going to be around March or April, but I would look for it in the later part of the winter.
Excellent. I'll tell you what, for the folks listening live, the best place to go really is facebook.com/GrailQuestBooks or facebook.com/WarsUniverse. All, of course, run together. That's a great place to keep up with you guys. Nathan Butler's the author of Healers and Hunters in the Wars franchise. Of course, Sean Williams is the author of The Great Journey. And not to forget Jim Perry, Firefight at Overwatch Command. And, of course, so much more coming from the Wars Universe franchise. Let me just tell you guys, as a humble little podcaster here on Middle Earth Network, I'd like to publicly thank Mark Ostley, Michael Kaiser, the station director, and so much more of those guys who handed this off to me and let me go ahead and do this. And it's been a great exploratory journey of my own to learn about this franchise from the actual authors. And it just kind of, in ways, it boggles my mind that I can actually learn about a franchise that I'm interested in reading and finding out more about by talking to the actual authors in a call and bringing you guys to your current audience and, of course, a much bigger and more expanding audience of all the people listening to this live now and listening to this in the podcast feed over at StarWarsReport.com and, of course, the podcast feed for the live specials. So we got all kinds of folks listening. Again, head over to Facebook.com/WarsUniverse for more details. And if you want to find out a little bit more about what Bethany and I do, if you're interested in the Star Wars thing, there's a couple folks. I know a few of you are out there. Go over to Facebook.com/StarWarsReport or just StarWarsReport.com. That would be great. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Thank you, Jim, for coming on. Oh, and Jim, I think... Oh, and Skype... You know what? We get all the way through the whole process, and Skype somehow holds on the whole way through, the awkward pauses and all, and I think we dropped Jim. Jim, are you there? If not, we'll have to jump on past him. I feel bad. But Jim... thank you so much, Jim Perry.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he's there. Yes. All right.
There he is again. I got off and got back on.
Excellent. Excellent. Sean, thank you so much for coming on. Sean Williams.
Thank you, guys.
Of course, I'm sure this is for our
See that lag?
Yeah. There is that lag. It always makes things more awkward than they actually are. But Sean, of course, not the author of The Force Unleashed, just for a little in-joke on the Star Wars audience.
Yeah, no, I'm Sean E. Williams, although I have a close friendship with evil Australian Sean Williams, who wrote The Force Unleashed.
Oh, really? Fascinating. We'll get you back on the show and talk to you more about that as well. And, of course,
Sounds
Nathan
good.
Patrick Butler, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, good to be back with you again.
Yeah, and super excited about your new podcast, Star Wars Beyond the Film. So you can also find that on Facebook as well. Just do a little bit of a searching around. I'm sure you'll find it. And Josh from DrellQuest Books, thank you. Thank you so much for orchestrating this, bringing all of this amazing creative talent here live on Middle Earth Network Radio. Really appreciate it, Josh.
It's my pleasure.
All right, it's a pleasure to talk to you, gentlemen. We'll go ahead and sign off for the podcast. But thank you so much for coming on. You've been listening to Middle Earth Network specials live on Middle Earth Network Radio. A last little plug, if you want to listen to the radio live, head over to mymeradio.us and join us on Star Wars Report weekly at Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern time, not to forget. That's a wrap. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the Star Wars Report. I've been Riley.
And Bethany.
And we need a catchy sign-off here. You've been listening to Middle Earth Network Radio. Bothans are dying. All right, that does.